My name is Michael McCusker. I have sort of a potpourri this morning. I was too lazy to do any of my own writing, so I thought I'd read some things that interest me a great deal. One, and I shall begin, with Frank Rich, No One Listened to Gabrielle Giffords. And this was in the Sunday, January 16th, 2011, Sunday Opinion of the New York Times. The Great Gray Lady. Of whom a former Oregonian reporter, Bill Keller, is the executive editor, if none of you knew that. Of the many truths in President Obama's powerful Tucson speech, none was more indisputable than his statement that no one can know what is in a killer's mind. So why have we spent so much time debating exactly that? The answer is classic American denial. It was easier to endlessly parse Jared Lee Loeffner's lunatic library. Did he favor the Communist Manifesto or Ayn Rand? Than confront the larger and harsher snapshots of our current landscape that emerged after his massacre. Nearly 2 weeks on, that denial is becoming even more entrenched. As soon as the president left the podium last Wednesday night, we started shifting into our familiar spin-dry post-tragedy cycle of the modern era. Speedy closure, and that's in parentheses, I beg your pardon, it's in quotes, but it could be in parentheses, followed by a return to business as usual, followed by national amnesia. If we learn nothing from this tragedy, we are back where we started, and where we started was with 2 years of accelerating political violence, actual violence, not to be confused with violent language, that struck fear into many, not the least of whom was Gabrielle Giffords. For the sake of this discussion, let's stipulate that Loeffner was a lone nut job, and that's in quotes, who had never listened to Glenn Beck or had been a card-carrying member of either the T or Communist parties. Let's also face another tragedy. The only two civic reforms that might have actually stopped him, tighter gun control, and an effective mental health safety net, will not materialize even now. Gun and ammunition sales spiked last week, especially for the specific varieties given the Loeffner imprimatur. No editorial or bloodbath will move Congress to enact serious gun control, which Giffords herself never advocated, and Obama has rarely pushed since 2008. Enhanced mental health coverage is also a non-starter when the highest GOP priority is to repeal the federal expansion of health care. In Arizona, cutbacks are already so severe that terminally ill patients are being denied life-saving organ transplants. The other inescapable reality was articulated by Sarah Palin, believe it or not, in her Blood Libel video. Speaking of a criminous partisan debate, she asked, when was it less heated? Back in those calm days when political figures literally settled their differences with dueling pistols? And she is right. Calls for civility will have no more lasting impact on the tone of American discourse now than they did after the JFK assassination or Oklahoma City. Especially not in an era when technology allows all 300 million Americans a cost-free megaphone for unmediated rants. Did Loeffner see Palin's own most notorious contribution to the rancorous tone, her March 2010 web graphic targeting congressional districts? We have no idea, nor does it matter. But Giffords did. Her reaction to it, captured in an interview she did back then with Chuck Todd of MSNBC, was the most recycled, if least understood, video of last week. The week of that interview began with the House passing the health care bill on Sunday. Within hours of on Monday morning, vandals smashed the front door of Gifford's office in Tucson. The Palin target map and the accompanying Twitter dictum to reload, and that's in caps, capital letters, went up on Tuesday, just one day after that vandalism, timing that was at best tone deaf and at worst nastily provocative. Not just Giffords, but at least three other of the 20 members of Congress on the Palin map were also hit with vandalism or death threats. In her MSNBC interview that Wednesday, Giffords said that Palin had put the crosshairs of a gun sight over our district, adding that when people do that, they've got to realize there's consequences to that action. Chuck Todd then asked Giffords if, in fairness, campaign rhetoric and war rhetoric have been interchangeable for years. She responded that colleagues who had been in the House 20, 30 years had never seen vitriol this bad. But Todd moved on, and so did the Beltway. What's the big deal about a little broken glass? Few wanted to see what Giffords saw, that the vandalism and death threats were the latest consequences of a tide of ugly insurrectionism that had been rising since the final weeks of the 2008 campaign and that had threatened to turn violent from the start. Giffords' first brush with that reality had occurred some 7 months before her office was vandalized, in the red-hot health care fever of August 2009. She had held another Congress on Your Corner meeting at a Safeway in a town of Douglas, Arizona. There, the crowd's rage and the dropping of a gun by one attendee prompted aides worried about her safety to summon the police. The Tucson Tea Party co-founder, Trent Humphreys, told the Arizona Daily Star afterward that this was a lie, that nobody was threatening Gabby. After Loeffner's massacre, Humphreys was still faulting her, this time for holding, quote, an event in full view of the public with no security whatsoever, unquote. Others on the right spent last week loudly protesting the politicization of tragedy. What was most revealing was how often they tried to rewrite the history of previous incidents having nothing to do with Loeffner. A Palin aide claimed that her target map was only invoking a surveyor's symbol, not gun sights. A Tucson Tea Party leader announced that the attack on Giffords' office, never solved by the police, was probably caused by skateboarding kids. Mike Pence, a potential GOP values candidate for president, told the C-SPAN audience that those bearing firearms at congressional town hall meetings and Obama events, including one in Arizona that August of 2009, were no different from anti-Bush demonstrators, quote, waving placards, unquote. For macabre absurdity, it would seem hard to top Newt Gingrich, who wailed about leftists linking Loeffner to the right, as if he had not famously blamed a psychotic double murder of 1994, Susan Smith's drowning of her two sons in South Carolina, on Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. But Representative Trent Franks, Republican of Arizona, did top Newt. On Meet the Press last Sunday, and that's the Sunday before this, he implored us to treat each other as fellow children of God, without acknowledging or even being questioned about his 2009 diatribe branding Obama as an enemy of humanity, quote unquote. As the president said in Tucson, we lack not just civil discourse, but honest discourse. Much of last week's televised bloviation was dishonest, dedicated to the pious feel-good sentiment that both sides are equally culpable for the rage of the past 2 years. To construct this false equivalency, every left-leaning website and Democratic politician's record was dutifully culled for incendiary invective. If that is the standard, then both sides are equally at fault. Rhetoric can indeed be as violent on the left as on the right. But that sidesteps the issue. This isn't about angry blog posts or verbal fisticuffs. Since Obama's ascension, we've seen repeated incidents of political violence. Just a short list would include the 2009 killing of three Pittsburgh police officers by a neo-Nazi Obama hater, last year's murder-suicide kamikaze attack, by airplane if you remember, on an IRS office in Austin, Texas, and the California police shootout with an assailant plotting to attack an obscure liberal foundation obsessively vilified by Beck. Obama said correctly last Wednesday that a simple lack of civility didn't cause the Tucson tragedy. It didn't cause these other incidents either. What did inform the earlier violence, including the vandalism at Gifford's office, was an anti-government radicalism as rabid on the right now as it was on the left in the 1960s. That Loeffner was likely insane with no coherent ideological agenda does not mean that a climate of anti-government hysteria has no effect on him or other crazed loners out there. Nor does Loeffner's insanity mitigate the surge in unhinged political zealots acting out over the last 2 years. That's why so many, on both the finger-pointing left and the hyper-defensive right, automatically assumed he must be another of them. Have politicians stoked the pre-Loeffner violence by advocating that citizens pursue Second Amendment remedies or be armed and dangerous? We don't know. What's more disturbing is what Republican and conservative leaders have not said. Their continuing silence during 2 years of simmering violence has been chilling. A few unexpected voices have expressed alarm. After an anti-government gunman struck at Washington's Holocaust Museum in June 2009, Shepard Smith of Fox News noted the rising vitriol in his email traffic and warned on air that more amped up, and that's a quote, Americans could be getting the gun out, and that's another quote. The former Bush administration speechwriter David Frum took on the reckless right that August, citing the incident at the Gifford Safeway event. But when a Department of Homeland Security report warned of far-right extremism and attacks by lone wolves that same summer, Gingrich called it a smear, and John Boehner demanded an apology. Last week, a conservative presidential candidate, Tim Pawlenty, timidly said it wouldn't be his style to use Palin's target map, but was savaged so viciously by his own camp that he immediately retreated. A senior Republican senator told Politico that he saw the Tucson bath as a cautionary tale for his party, yet refused to be named. What are they and their peers so afraid of? No doubt that someone might reload. The same fears that prompted Gabrielle Giffords to speak up calmly but firmly last March. Unless and until they can match her courage and speak out also, it's hard to see what will change. And that's Frank Rich. No one listened to Gabrielle Giffords. And that was in the Sunday New York Times this past Sunday. I'd sort of like to follow that up with another New York Times article, actually from earlier this month, before the Tucson massacre, or the Tombstone, as even people are calling it. It's called No, They Are Not Hitler or a Stalin by Timothy Snyder, who is professor of history at Yale History, and author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. For an American historian who researches totalitarianism and genocide, nothing is more disheartening than facile comparisons sometimes heard between Western leaders and Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin. When we are so wrong about history, we do a great injustice to ourselves. The Stalin comparison rests on a basic misunderstanding of the history of communism. Americans often seem to think that social reforms are somehow steps toward communism. History tells a different story. Communism has never once arisen, not in the USSR, not in China, not in Cambodia, not in Cuba, not in Vietnam, not in North Vietnam, in North Korea, as the cumulative result of social reforms. It was always brought by violent revolution carried out by a fanatical minority, usually during or right after war. Once in power, committed revolutionaries sought to transform agrarian countries, such as Russia or China, into modern industrial states by oppressing peasants and applying political terror. The history of the welfare state is actually part of the history of the struggle against communism. After World War II, wise Europeans and Americans supported social reforms precisely as a way to hinder the spread of Soviet power. The Red Army had brought communism to Eastern Europe. The question was how to prevent its further spread to the nations liberated by the Western powers. In war-torn Western Europe, democratic politicians of the left and right agreed that the extension of state services was the best way to assure democracy and to prevent revolution. Their policies were backed and enabled by the far-sighted American aid provided by the Marshall Plan. American statesmen understood that the best way to prevent radical politics was to create contented societies. The welfare state worked so well that most recipients of Marshall Plan aid are now more prosperous than the United States. In Western Europe, social democracy stopped Stalin. What about Eastern Europe, where Stalin's supporters ruled by force? Under communism, Eastern European states indeed offered their populations public health care, retirement pensions, and the like. When the peoples of Eastern Europe liberated themselves from communist rule in 1989, however, they did not do away with these institutions of the public good. Instead, they funded their public services with tax revenues drawn from their new market economies. If you tell Eastern Europeans that their public rail systems are a step toward Stalinism, they will think you are crazy. Comparisons with Hitler are, if possible, even more far-fetched. The ideological foundation of the Nazi regime was racism. Hitler was a racist who believed that some Germans were real Germans and other Germans were not. The Jews, the handicapped, the long-term unemployed, the homosexuals, the Roma, the biracial. He thought that democratic politicians of the left should be placed in concentration camps. Hitler saw the outside world through the prism of a racial hierarchy, with Germans at the top and Jews and Slavs as racial enemies to be eliminated. He began the worst war in history to gain a colonial empire for the people he saw as a racial elite and killed millions of Jews and other Europeans along the way. Had Barack Obama been born in Nazi Germany, of one white and one African parent, he would have been sterilized. His election as president was actually one of the strongest refutations ever offered to Nazi ideology. It goes without saying that Hitler and Stalin controlled parties that opposed democracy and legitimated themselves by ideology, propaganda, and force rather than free elections. In both the Nazi and Stalinist cases, the rise to power required violence and the sustenance of the regime more violence. That some people would compare their own peacefully elected president to ideological mass murderers is a sign of reckless and shameful disregard for some of the most important lessons of history. And it is troubling to recall just who, in history, profited most from comparisons to Hitler and Stalin. Hitler and Stalin themselves. Each treated his political opponents as being in league with the other, and each thereby destroyed any middle ground for sensible debate. In the 1930s, they together reduced political discussion to demagogic imagery, making it much harder for well-intentioned Democrats to carry out sensible public discourse. No Western democracy recalls this age of totalitarianism. But the reckless comparisons of Obama or other democratically elected leaders to Hitler or Stalin do. Let us resolve to think and think deeply before we evoke them again. And that was by Timothy Snyder. No, they are not a Hitler or a Stalin. And that was run in the New York Times on January 3rd this year. And he is a professor of history at Yale and author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. Now I'd like to read something by Henry Bonta. And he wrote this for Nieman Watchdog. It's the GOP's communist-style rigidity. Republican Party pronouncements on the economy are stuck in a failed, wildly unrealistic ideology unlike anything in the history of the American capitalist system. For uncritical acceptance of beliefs, it is somewhat like Stalinism, writes Henry Bonta. And this is by Henry Bonta. Over the last three decades, the Republican Party has become trapped in a rigid ideology. At the center are economic principles which radically depart from the common sense pragmatism that used to characterize our capitalist system. Worse, this ideology requires the uncritical acceptance of beliefs that are simply untrue, based on assumptions about how markets work that are hopelessly inconsistent with overwhelming evidence. In clinging to their ideology, these Republicans are doing a very credible imitation of the old hardcore communists, who could not or would not accept that their system was grounded on propositions that flew in the face of human experience. Republican leaders cannot accept the fact that markets occasionally produce perverse results and that some level of government intervention is necessary to avoid catastrophe. Even in the aftermath of the crisis of 2007-2008, they still cannot acknowledge the need for government action. Their ideology requires them to not only deny any responsibility for what happened, but to deny any role for the government in cleaning up their mess. All they can offer is further deregulation and more tax cuts for the rich. In fact, no matter the issue, their policy is always the same: less taxes, less government. Ideas like these should be ridiculed by an opposition party, but hardly any Democrats say much except to warn against a return of Bush-era failures. Some seem not to trust the public to understand issues, and some may even share the GOP ideology, having heard it for so long. The press is also at fault. For many journalists, being objective means not saying one party has worse ideas than another, no matter how absurd its positions. The less government ideology is based on the efficient market theory. For the Republican ideologues, the efficient market will create an economy of awesome wealth and abundance. It requires only low taxes, an absolute minimum of government regulation, barely more than what is necessary to enforce private contracts, and avoiding even a hint of inflation. It aspires to a state of perfect equilibrium, where markets work flawlessly. It has been an eerie resemblance to the old communist utopian vision of a workers' paradise. The assumptions behind the efficient market theory have always been wildly unrealistic. To start, it assumes everyone is able to make perfectly rational economic decisions on the basis of perfect information, even about the future, and that markets always accurately and efficiently value all assets. Hence, there is no possibility of a bubble. Like most ideologues, the efficient market guys have a hostility to testing their theory against empirical reality. Their favorite economist, Milton Friedman, actually disparaged any effort to support the theory with empirical evidence. Since the theory predicted that the market would punish businesses and consumers that did not act as rational economic men, and that's a quote, there was no need to examine actual market behavior. One should just trust that things would come out as the theory predicted. The efficient market ideologues seem incapable of absorbing any useful lesson, not just from the crises of 2007-2008, but from the savings and loan debacle, the Enron scandal, the collapse of long-term capital management, or the dot-com bubble. Standing firmly in this tradition, House Minority Leader Boehner calls for a continuation of the Bush economic policies without even mentioning where they got us. One would think that a financial system taken to the edge of collapse and 10 million unemployed would deserve comment. Clearly, evidence doesn't matter. Blind faith in the efficient market theory does. Most troublesome for the rest of us is that the Republicans have become incapable of compromise. Compromise, for the ideologue, involves a breach of faith, a betrayal of basic principles and values. The ordinary give and take that has always characterized government in a pluralistic and democratic society becomes, in the eyes of the ideologue, reprehensible. Flirting with opposition must be punished. Like old Stalinists in pursuit of Trotskyites, the Republicans have been relentless in trying to purge their ranks of heretics. Party members who depart from the pure ideology are subject to expulsion, or, like poor John McCain, forced into humiliating recantations. Nevertheless, there have been defections. Most prominent, perhaps, was that of Judge Richard Posner of the U.S. Seventh Circuit of Appeals. Judge Posner, a Republican, a Reagan appointee, was a leader of the Chicago School of Economists, known for his work in applying the efficient market theories to legal problems. He announced his defection in an article in the New Republic entitled, How I Became a Keynesian, September 23, 2009. Perhaps nothing more clearly demonstrates the hostility of Republican politicians to economic evidence than their indifference to the effect of their policies on the middle class. This parallels the hypocrisy of the communist elite who pretended to advance the cause of the working class while indulging in an extravagant lifestyle. Republicans endlessly talk about the middle class but consistently implement policies that only benefit the very rich. As the Wall Street Journal recently noted, the years of Republican rule have not been very good for the middle class. The wealthiest 20% of the American population claimed 43.3% of household income in 1970, but controlled 50% by 2008. And that was the Wall Street Journal last year in August 5th. And this way understates how dramatically their policies have benefited the very rich. A recent study shows that between 1993 and 2008, the top 1% captured 52% of the real annual income growth. It is almost impossible to find a Republican politician who is willing to even discuss, much less explain, why we have had such a massive shift in wealth and income to the very rich, or why the trend accelerated during the Bush years, or even more importantly, why the period between World War II and the 1970s, a period denounced by Ronald Reagan as an era of big government, high taxes, and stifling regulation, saw the biggest growth in middle-class wealth and income in American history. Again, like the old communists, the Republicans more and more depend on blatant propaganda for political support. Of course, Republicans would deny dealing in propaganda, but they very clearly have friends, lots of close friends, who shamelessly use it. Remember death panels, the birth certificate, the Obama TARP bailout, secular European socialism, Kenyan anti-colonialism, or anything that Beck, Limbaugh, or Hannity may say next? Practical politicians run a big risk when they embrace the rhetoric of a simplistic and rigid ideology. There are always those who can find fault in the purity of their position. No matter how extreme their stance, there is someone willing to go a step further. The radical efficient market ideology is singularly vulnerable. There is no logical limit to the call for less government and lower taxes. As the Tea Party has demonstrated, the genie is out of the bottle. None of this suggests that the Republicans cannot win elections, if for no other reason than that the Democrats are utterly incapable of articulating an alternate economic theory. In times of great uncertainty, people fall back on their basic beliefs. For more than 30 years, the public has heard little but the simplistic slogans of right-wing economics. Now they are groping for certainties of the past. There is a great appeal in placing the blame on a betrayal of the old faith. Government is bad. Taxes are bad. Regulation is bad. But in the end, if the Republicans succeed in perpetuating their failed ideology, their children and grandchildren are unlikely to forgive them. And that was by Henry M. Banta, the GOP's communist-style rigidity. And he is a partner in the Washington, D.C. law firm of Lobel, Novins, and Lamont. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.